I also would like to first thank the organizers for the invitation. So this is a joint work with several people. Long Song Liu, Zhipeng Qiu, Dazhen Xu, and Yiling Yang. There are some of them are former postdocs at Purdue, and some are former students at Purdue or visitors from China. And last but not least, John Glasser, everybody knows him, from CDC in the US. So, he has been a major driving force for this project, started a while ago. So the motivation of this work was for influenza or other respiratory infectious diseases, if antiviral treatment is used in the population, then with a certain probability, drug resistance can develop. And in that case, the final size or many other measures for the prevalence or the disease outbreak can be very different comparing with the environment where no medication is used. And in addition, if you consider possibility of development of drug resistance, then it's important to consider several clinical stages. And yesterday we have seen one slide that Professor Ferguson showed about the viral load, influenza viral load. So you can see that the viral load is peaked around day 2, 48 hours. And then so the viral load decreased. So if we assume that the probability of resistant development is associated with viral load, for example, if we consider the recent development due to mutation of virus, for example, then when you have higher viral load, then the chance of developing resistance will be higher. So so that's one motivation that we need to consider multiple clinical stages according to the viral load or also according to the drug efficacy. Because for influenza, if you use the antiviral drug in the first couple of days, then it's more likely the drug may have some effect. But if you use at a later stage, the efficacy may be lower, and also the other differences. Okay, in between, you use a drug earlier or later, and also for diseases like influenza, another control. Medication is the prophylaxis. So you use the prophylaxis before you become infectious. So the possibility of being infected or develop to be infectious will be lower. So that's another motivation that we need to consider multiple stages. But then if you consider multiple stages, the model can become more complicated. Okay. If you consider multiple strains, sensitive and resistant, and for the sensitive strain, you have a treated class and untreated class, plus multiple clinical stages. And as I'll show you later, the model is a system of 15 equations. So the amount of analysis, the mathematical analysis you can do will be very limited, so you will rely more on simulations. But before I talk about this more complicated model, I'd like to talk a little bit about a much simpler model. An SIR model with just one stage for the I class, instead of multiple infection stages. The motivation of this model, obviously is different otherwise. What consider more complicated model instead of a simple one? Because for this model, we don't worry about resistance. Okay, the purpose of this model is to predict the course of H1N1 pandemic influenza last year. Okay, so this is a sort of, a lot of work have been done that, you compare your model prediction with data afterwards. But this work was done before the epidemic peak was reached. This work was mainly, done by Sherry Tower, I think she's here, at Purdue. And so this work was started when she contacted me and said she wanted to do a summer reading course last summer. She already had a PhD degree in physics, and she was working on a master's degree in statistics. But she got interested in epidemiological modeling. So then we start talking about how to model according to the questions she's interested in. First, she wanted to do aging-based model. Okay, consider schools and population and hospitals and household and everything. But that model can become very complicated, and especially you want to model U.S. population, so the population size is very big. Even you consider Lafayette, West Lafayette, where Purdue is, still the population is pretty, consider aging-based model can be very large. And then we talk about ODE model, so a deterministic model, just a simple SIR, that you may have to consider the assumption that yesterday or 2 days ago, Dr. Ping Yang mentioned that when you assume you want to use the ODE model with a single stage, then basically the underlying assumption is that the disease stage is exponentially distributed. And if you consider control strategies like quarantine and isolation, then the model with exponential distribution assumption can be may not be appropriate. They may produce misleading information in terms of the effectiveness of control strategies. So we can say maybe we include distributed stages. But then the model also can be difficult to analyze, okay, for a summer course, or at least. And then we also talk about the age structure. So yesterday we saw a couple of examples like age dependent. So you have so diagonal, right? We saw the age dependent contact patterns. People tend to have a higher contact rates with their own age groups, but also there's off diagonal between parents and the children. And then you consider age structure, the model can also be very complicated. So eventually she decided to work on a very simple SIR model without any of those factors. So the paper was submitted October 8th, published on October 15th. So how the model actually predict when the peak will be reached for the second wave, because most people expect a second wave after summer wave, and how large the peak will be, and then how the vaccination can help with the reduction of the epidemics or pandemics. Okay. Before I show you, the comparison between the model prediction and what actually happened in terms of pandemic, maybe I'll quickly talk about the model, how the prediction was, how the model was used to generate those predictions. So this is probably one of the most familiar graphs. That the influenza data, okay, published by CDC. The orange ones are for H1N1. Okay. So after the summer, so that's in week, January 1st, so that's about September somewhere, sometime. So from this available data, and if we use this very simple SIR model, without demographics, no birth, no death, okay, just the infection and a recovery. The only difficult or only non-trivial factor considered in this model is this time-dependent transmission rate. Okay, that's due to seasonal variation in the context. So that will be assumed as a periodic function with two constants, beta 0 and beta 1, So those are the components you need to estimate from data. And the third one is this initial time, the time for the initial introduction of the case. And that will appear in the initial condition. Okay. So using data in the summer prior to the, you know, to the study, and she tried to estimate those three parameters. And of course, before you do the statistics, you have to sort of identify, right, which data to use, how to use the data, because very often the report data may be biased. For example, here you see the sudden increase in the H1N1, that's probably due to the increased testing. So obviously, if you directly use that data, your model prediction may not be accurate. So she decided after, you know, I don't understand much about the statistics, but she decided that the data between week 21 and 23 can be used for the parameter estimation. So the values for those three parameters are in the second column with the confidence interval, 95% confidence interval, in the third column. So with those parameter values, plus the consideration of vaccination. So at that time, the vaccine for H1N1 was not available, was not used. But there was a plan for distribution of the vaccine. And considering those in the model, so the way the vaccination was considered is simply remove susceptible to recovered class, according to the program. So the prediction of the model is that, so that was the time, the submission, the peak will be reached near the end of October, near Halloween. And the final reduction due to vaccination is about 6%. Okay. So then you have to wait until what actually happened, right? So the model prediction usually, in this kind of prediction, when the peak will be reached, they most likely can, will not be a good match. So still get a lot of media reports. But what they emphasize is, like what title suggests, the H1N1 vaccine will be too late to help most of you Americans. That's not, of course, not the point of this study. So vaccine should still be helpful for healthy people in terms of many factors. So this study was also mentioned in the U.S. Senate committee about H1N1 response. Okay. And I think the answer was similar. Okay, the model, you can't predict how pathogen will actually behave in any outbreaks. But now, because most, if you look at the past, influenza, most time the peak occur after the end of the year, okay, in February or January. But now we can see what happened in 2009, the peak was reached near October, end of October. So the comparison between the model prediction and what actually happened, that's what actually happened, according to the CDC report. H1N1 pandemic. So in terms of Tmax, the time where the peak was reached was pretty good match. Okay. But in terms of final size, at the end of the year, how many people, what percent of the population will actually got infected or fall ill, that could would not be very close, because other prevention measures, right? And those school closure or increased people to wash hands or that kind of thing. And besides the vaccination became available, so all factors will contribute to the final size. But in terms of Tmax, the time of the peak, it was pretty good. All right, so that was the story about the simple model. Okay. But now I'm going to go back to the original talk, the more complicated model. when you have to consider multiple stages. There are several drugs for influenza, depending on the strains, and also there are pre-exposure medication, post-symptoms medication, or prophylaxis. Okay. So they are all they play different roles, and also in terms of development of drug resistance, can be very different. So this is another figure similar to what was shown yesterday, the viral load. Okay, those are for different patients. You can see that the peak of the viral load occurred between day 2 and day 3, and then it will decrease. So we can divide the whole infectious stages into several clinical stages according to the viral load, and also the difference in terms of effectiveness, the drug, how when if a person used the antiviral drug, how the infection period may be reduced, and the probability of the disease, or the probability that the resistance can be developed due to the drug use. So those are the clinical stages we're going to consider in the model. Okay. So those are some relationship between infection stages, between treated and untreated individuals. The diagram. Okay. So this sort of generalization of a simple model published by Mark Lipschitz and his group with only one infectious state, only I, there's no exposure, no multiple clinical stages. So we generalize that by including more stages. So the green one in the middle for sensitive strain untreated, and the blue on the top, sensitive strain treated, and the red one on the bottom, resistant strains. So a susceptible individual can be take a prophylaxis, so we'll be moved to the SP, and those people may have some kind of immunity against the sensitive strain, but not against the resistant strain. The lambda S, that's the transmission rate for the sensitive strain. If a person is exposed, so they move into the exposed stage, and they can take a pre-exposure medication, FP, that's the fraction of the class, the individual in that class that will receive prophylaxis, and with probably CP, they can develop resistance. So with probably with the rate FP, they will move to the treated class. And in each of the infectious stages, okay, prodrome stage, the acute, the respiratory stage, or the mild, there's at the end of the infectious stage. So at each stage, there's a fraction of population will be treated, will receive treatment. And similar terms, okay, they can develop resistance, they will become treated, okay, but all the C's can be different and the F can be different, and they will recover. And if a person receives treatment, they can so those people will not receive treatment. Okay, so in general, if you have multiple strains in a system, yesterday Professor Kaller mentioned that the sensitive strain, if you don't have treatment, okay, very likely the resistant strain, because of the cost of resistance, they may have lower fitness. So when they compete with sensitive strain, they may not be able they are the inferior competitor. Okay, so if we don't, they may according to competitive exclusion, they may not actually persist in the population. But if drug is used, then the player roles kind of selection force for the resistant strain. Then the competitive ability may change. So depending on the level of treatment, the F, so the F parameters will be very important for this study. And this C's, the probability of development of resistance, those are the key parameters, okay, F and the P. So we're gonna look at how those will affect the competition between two strains, and how would that affect the final size of the epidemic. So that's the equation, 15 equations. So I'll skip that. Now, you can actually calculate the refraction numbers for each string and additional parameter related to the acquired resistance. Right? If a person becomes infected with a resistant string, there are two ways to get it. One is through direct contact with another person with a resistant string. Another way is by development of resistance due to treatment. So that was called acquired resistance, yeah, as opposed to transmitted resistance. So there you have another number associated with the acquired resistance. So there are several refraction numbers. And what happened between the two strings will be dependent on the interaction between all those reproduction numbers. Okay, we can actually compute those numbers for this large system, but since there are so many parameters and so many factors, it's not easy to actually to say a lot from those numbers. So after this demonstration, the mathematical demonstration, I will show you another simpler model, and I will illustrate how those reproduction numbers may help understand the whole the computation between two strings. Okay, so this simulation we will use Mathematica to to illustrate how different treatment programs may affect the final size and the time when the peak may be reached, and the fraction of the population that has drug resistance. Okay. So FP, that's a fraction of population that receive prophylaxis, and FT for treatment post exposure, and those Cs are the probability for the development of resistance. So if we change F. So there were three curves on the left figure. The blue one, the green one is for sensitive string. And the red one is for resistant string, and the blue one is for total. So this is the cumulative cases, times and days. And the figure on the right, that's the epidemic curve. Okay, this number of infected people at given time. Again, the green one for sensitive, red one for resistant, and the blue one for total. And if we change this parameter, so you can observe how this how the peak right will be shifted to the right. So that's good because you get more time to develop the new vaccine, and also the final size in the beginning, you see this reduced in the beginning. But at some point, the treatment, when you continue to increase treatment, they may not actually decrease the final size, but may actually increase the final size. And similarly, if you change FP, you observe similar. Like when you see all red, that means the whole population, all the cases are resistant. Okay, so that would not be good. And the bottom table, you can actually see how those numbers, the peak size, time to peak, and final size, and the fractional resistance, those numbers will change with the parameter. Okay. And then you can actually compare the FP and FT, so prophylaxis versus medication, how effective those are in terms of all those measures. Okay. And you can also conduct stochastic simulations using Mathematica. And so for the similar so you consider this event, like we there are many different approaches for stochastic simulation. So this is particular the method we use here is the so-called time event approach. So you basically assume that the time to next event is exponential distributed, and then you decide which event it is among so many events, right? Infection, recover, and then develop resistance, and so on. So if you do that, then you can create those curves. So this is a 25 realization. Okay, you can adjust that. You can have different number of realizations, and you can actually see. So there's a mean. The red one tells the mean final size, but you can also see how variable, right? Different runs, different realizations. And some may be very low, some may be very high, and you can see also here. So that's why sometimes, you know, even though you have those parameters, you may not observe the outbreak. That's because, you know, the stochastics, right, involved in the process. And you can also calculate the possibility that population, certain fraction of population, will become infected at the end of the outbreak. So all those informations are more useful for policymakers instead of using just some different deterministic outcomes. Okay. So, so I don't have much time. I'll go quickly that this. The reflection numbers. Okay. So this is a simplified version of the bigger diagram. Now you just have one infection. This is actually closer to the paper published by Mark Lipschitz and his group. I accept that this model has a vaccinated class. Okay. So for this model, you can do mathematical analysis. It's much simpler. You can actually compute the reproduction number for sensitive strain under control, resistant strain under control, and all those numbers. And actually, those two numbers completely determine the mathematical properties of the system in terms of stability of tribal equilibrium or endemic equilibrium star, or the equilibrium at which only resistance strain is present. So those two reproduction numbers determine this outcome, but it doesn't capture the phenomena that we observe that when you increase the treatment rate, first you see the decrease in the final size, but after a certain point, you see the final size increasing with the treatment, with increasing treatment. So this two reflection numbers obviously cannot capture that because they are all linear in terms of F. So this is simplifying, under simplifying assumption that all the F are equal, because you just want to see how this reflection numbers will actually can help understand the role of medication use in terms of outbreaks. So F is the parameter here. You see the this number is linear in terms of F, so that doesn't capture this nonlinear phenomenon. And so that's a third. So I'll skip that. This tells you how the vaccination rate and the treatment, the joint effect of those two. Okay. So this is another example. So you see this cumulative case, okay, blue one. Decrease with the increasing treatment, but at some point it turns become increasing. So we would like to be able to capture this if we can develop some kind of measure. If it's not a classical reproduction number, that may be another measure that can actually capture this phenomenon. So what we did is to find out why the conventional reproduction number doesn't show the dependence, the nonlinear dependence on F. So we look at this simple diagram. So if you start with a sensitive strain, assume that the R 0 to 3. So on average, each person can produce 3 new cases in the susceptible population. But if you have a treatment and there's a probability for resistance to develop, then say one of the 3 cases become resistant, then the next generation, so the conventional reflection number, they talk about next generation, or second generation. So you talk about many generations, take average, so you really just consider one generation. But if you consider one more generation, okay, you see that after one generation, you add them all together, that's RTC, that's linear function of F. But if you consider one more generation, because the newly arise the resistance, they can transmit new resistance. Okay, and the reflection number may be different. It may be lower, but it's different. They can produce more. The treatment is not useful for resistant strain. So you compute a second generation, you get a new number, and this number, ideally you like to compute a many, many generations and take average, but even up to this, the third, the one more generation, you can already see that this function is nonlinear in F, and you can actually calculate a critical point of the treatment at which the curve becomes increasing. So that reflects the simulation shows this phenomenon. Okay, so that's the measure that I was mentioned in the abstract, that you know, different measure, different from the conventional reproduction number, that can actually at least capture this nonlinear dependence on the treatment rate. So I think I ran out of my time. So thank you for your attention, and that's supported by CDC and NISF.